there it goes. Okay, just a couple of words about chronology. We just covered. I should have recognized. I should have talked about this. If I knew about this, we would go into Chronicles ahead of time. I'd have had this ready last week. I guess I ran my mouth enough last week. This 1 Chronicles 2, verses 3 through 15, we see the descendants of Judah, right? And if we go to Matthew chapter 1 and Ruth chapter 4, we'll see basically the same thing. I'm not going to go repeat everything in Chronicles, but it basically, the descent from Judah to David goes from Judah to Phares to Hezron to Ram or Aram, or as he's called in Matthew, to Aminadab, to Nashon, to Salmon, to Boaz, to Obed, to Jesse, to David. That's not a whole lot of generations. And if you think about it, that's damn near 1,000 years. From Judah to David, inclusively, there are only 11 generations mentioned in the Bible. There had to be more generations than that. We'll see that in a minute. Aminadab was in the Exodus. He's mentioned in Exodus chapter 6, verse 23. He's mentioned in Numbers chapter 1, verses 1, 2, 7, and 10. Where Paul at Galatians, in Galatians 3:17, Paul talks about 430 years, and he means from the time of the call of Abraham to the giving of the law at Sinai. And the generations and the chronology examining the Old Testament prove out that Paul is pretty accurate. Well, of these 430, the children of Egypt were really only in Egypt for about 214 years or so. And we're going to see 216 years maybe. We're going to see that now. Abraham was about 75 years old when he was called, and that's when Paul's counting his 430 years. The call of Abraham, Genesis chapter 12. He was 99 when Isaac was born, so that's 24 years, right? Jacob was 60, we see in the scripture, Isaac was 60 when Jacob was born. So if you add the 24 years of the call of Abraham to Isaac, and then from Isaac to the birth of Jacob, you have right there 84 years. Jacob was 130 when he saw Pharaoh in Egypt. 130 years and 84 years is 214 years. So there were 216 years left from the time Jacob went to Egypt all the way to the giving of the law at Mount Sinai, which was only about 2 months and change after the children of Israel left Egypt, right? Now, of those 216 years, of course, the Israelites weren't in captivity for the entire time. We see Jacob lived 17 more years, and the children of Israel still weren't in captivity. So the children of Israel were really only in captivity for 6 or 7 generations. Now I didn't get it ready for tonight. I might do it some other night. I have a chart, right? 75 people went to Egypt. And I have a chart, and I have all the mathematics laid out. And this is one of the first things that I did when I learned the identity message and sat and read the Bible back in 1997 for the first time, when I read the Bible through, I wanted to know how could they grow from 75 people to maybe they present men between 20 and 50 is about 600,000 people in a short amount of time, and I sat and did the math. And if you start out with 37 couples, right, which is 74 people, and you have every couple has 7 children during its 20 years of reproductive capability. And we see that people can reproduce for longer than 20 years. I mean, a woman can reproduce. A woman today, I hate to put a woman through that, but a woman today could reproduce for damn close to 30 years, some women, and not have a problem. Well, if every couple has 7 children in 20 years, then in 7 or 8 generations, 37 couples can very easily be 2 million people. It's real easy. And of course, some couples, that especially back then, just kept knocking out babies. And I had 6 kids with my wives in 8 years, I think it was. It's easy to have 7 kids in 20 years. And that's all it takes. So that's all. The children of Israel were in Egypt for 216 years, from the time of Jacob to the time of the giving of the law. That's it. We see that Hezron, who is the grandson of Judah, Hezron was already born, and he went to Egypt with Jacob. He's listed in Genesis as one of the 75. His grandson, Amminadab, now Hezron must have been a very young man when he went to Egypt. His grandson is an elder coming out in the Exodus. Moses is only 3 generations after Levi, and his great-grandfather, and Levi is his great-grandfather. Moses is 3 generations after Levi, and that's in 1 Chronicles chapter 6. We'll get to that soon. So if we have 430 years to the Exodus, and Nashon, the son of Amminadab, is already a grown man, Numbers chapter 10, we only have 5 generations left to David, from the Exodus to David. And the period of the judges is every bit of 450 years by itself. Acts 13:20, and you could examine the book of Judges and see this, where the years of the judges are mentioned. Acts 13:20 is fairly accurate, where it states that after that he gave unto them judges, meaning after the giving of the law at Sinai, right? He gave unto them judges about the space of 450 years until Samuel the prophet. So we have, with the reign of Saul included, you know, added to that 450 years, we might have just about 490 years until the time of David. And we only have 5 generations listed in the genealogy. That's a generation every 90 years. And my point is that, you know, we like to think the Bible and the records are complete, and in reality, they're far from complete. If you compare some of the genealogies here in Chronicles, I mean, I'm not going to go into it in great depth. I have notes. I might dig them out before we're done here. I have some notes that I did a long time ago, and they're buried in a box somewhere. And they actually show the differences between the genealogies in Chronicles and the genealogies earlier in Genesis. And sometimes sons that are really grandsons are listed as sons, and vice versa. And the words were used very loosely. A descendant of somebody could be a son of somebody in the Bible. And you could look somewhere else and it's his great-grandson. You could go back to Genesis and find out it's his grandson. But later on, he's called his son. So we have 5 generations, and I believe that the descent has to be correct. And the New Testament and the book of Ruth and Chronicles are all in tune with each other. But we only have 5 generations listed between the Exodus and David, between Amminadab and David. That's clearly a 490-year period from the time of the Exodus, the giving of the law at Sinai, to the time that David is king. So there had to be, I would think, more than 5 generations. Oh, even the lives of Obed and Jesse, they're not 90-something years old when they had their children. Yeah, you know, they may be grown men, but I don't think all those years are accounted for in this genealogy. I think that there are records that have just been lost. I mean, this is the Word of God, yes, but the Bible is not a complete account of the past. That's all I'm trying to say.
I think the high spots in the record confirm, though, families and tribes that are important to the faithfulness that Yahweh required of Himself in His own Word, you know, that we go back and are able to see that there's fulfillment of promises, and it's not always intended to be necessarily a complete record, but just
Well, right. No, that's absolutely right, and that's a healthy way and a good way of looking at it.
And that's real interesting too, that the number of people multiplies that quick. Because most people don't realize that when you start multiplying by seven each time, how fast it grows. But if you start trying to, when you get 75 people turning to 2 million in that period of time, then the 2 million over the next 400 something period of the judges very likely became, you know, there's a lot of people who doubt the existence of the great kingdoms of David and Solomon, simply on the basis that they don't see the historical record of it. But when you realize that that number of people grew exponentially like that, also there was a bunch of people around by the time of David and Solomon's kingdoms.
Well, without a doubt. I'm looking for the spreadsheet I got now, but I don't know if I'm going to be able to find it. It's something I did a long time ago, and I keep meaning to put it online, and every once in a while I see it, and it never quite makes it. But it's basically a the numbers prove it out, that all a couple has to do is have seven children over 20 years, and if you start out with 37 couples, and every couple, or every person has 3.5 children, right? Which means that every couple has to have seven. And you multiply, you know, your total by 3.5 and see over 8 generations how it balloons. And it gets to, within 8 generations, it gets to 2 million.
Well, if you doubt it, all you got to do is look at the niggers in Ringo and Shreveport.
Right, exactly. That's what 8 generations of welfare does. It turns a couple of thousand people into a couple million. There's no doubt.
Yeah, it's, if you ask somebody if they'd rather have $1 million or have a penny that doubles every day for 30 days, yeah, for us, you know, a lot of people think that penny won't come anywhere close, but in reality, if you take that penny and double it every day for 30 days, double the total amount and give them that every day, you've got a good bit more.
Right, you're a millionaire in no time at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'd take a job like that for 30 days. Hell yeah. Well, I just wanted to put that in perspective. We only have 11 generations, and it's almost it's 900 years. It's 430 plus 490. It's 910 years. And it is evident in the historical books and in the things that happened that it is 900 years. It's evident that David didn't become king until close to 1000 BC, and that Jacob was born around 1800 BC, and that's fully evident.
But it's accepted that 90 years is a generation?
Well, no, it's accepted that 20 or 25 years is you, or maybe 30 is a generation.
I said 90 years a minute ago. I was questioning that.
No, what I'm saying is that we only have 5 generations recorded as being born in a period of 450 years. That would require 90 years to a generation.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to demonstrate how it's much more likely that some of the records are just missing.
I got you. Okay, my bad.
Yeah, you know, I'm leaning towards the fact that there was probably a great gap of people in the records between Salmon and Boaz. That would, yeah, you know, that's a guess, but that's what I believe. That's what I lean towards. That in there, Salmon, Boaz, Obed, that there's a great gap in the records. And it might be 2, 3, 4, 6 generation. Who knows? We don't know. It's evident that men were having children. I mean, Isaac was only 60 when he had Jacob. Yeah, you know, the further away our people got from the flood, the younger they were when they had their children, right? They got married younger and younger. But we're not told at all, that I could see in the scripture, how old in the actual so-called canonical books, how old David was, how old Jacob was when he had his children. But we see that David lived what we would consider to be a pretty normal lifespan, right? Like 80, 90 years old in there, and that's all he lived.
We know that Jacob was fairly old, though, before he...
147. 147, but that was 800, 900 years before David, right?
Right. And, yeah. You know, the family generations and heritage, though, were much better known to these people than the what we have today, you know. And they probably lived, at least at that time, a little bit longer, but they also... You know, when you sit around and you sleep under the stars a lot, and we're talking tonight about how clear the sky was and the stars and how that is promised by Father to be a witness to his promises to his people. But when your occupations and lifestyles require you to tell your stories of your grandfathers, you remember your heritage a lot better. That's one of the things that's been robbed from us. Very few of us can tell you much about even our grandfathers, much less our great-grandfathers and great-great-grandfathers, because of the fact that we sit around and watch TV at night instead of telling our children about our heritage.
And also, it's been de-emphasized by schools and everything else. It's not important who your parents and as parents and all of that. The race doesn't matter. So people don't pay any attention to it anymore.
Well, you know, when I was teaching identity in prison for a long time, I'd get guys, young guys, guys from places as homogenous as Tennessee or West Virginia, and I'd ask them, you know, what they were, and they're like, I don't know. What do you mean, what am I? I'm from West Virginia. Well, are you Irish, Scotch, English, German? I don't know. I'm white. That's the answer I'd get. And I'd ask them what their grandfather's names were, and usually they couldn't tell you. Usually they couldn't tell you their mother's maiden name. Some of them knew it, but most of them, and the ones that could tell you their mother's maiden name, that they sure as hell didn't know their grandmother's maiden names. And that's pitiful.
Yeah, and even as such of not even knowing the names, but not having recollections of heritage stories of how that their great grandfather sacrificed for his honor, you know, or was able to be remembered as not being involved in iniquities and sins and things, things that we don't have to teach our kids today. We don't, you know, about how the blood that flows through their veins is royal and contains with it something to be proud of.
My grandmother upstairs is 93 years old, and she tells me about her grandparents, but I ask her questions, and I've asked her questions in the past, and I try to pry information out of her about uncles and grandparents and great-grandparents, and she can't tell me much. And when I ask her, Grandma, how come you don't know that? Her reply would be, William, when I was young, we didn't ask questions. We weren't supposed to ask questions. That's her reply to me. Now, she married a man that she was told to marry. She married an Englishman named Joseph Ashworth, and she doesn't know anything about him, and he died in a car accident before my mother was born. Now, so I have one grandfather I really don't know much about, and that's just the way it is. But my grandmother, my mother knew that he had sisters that were alive, you know, until recently. But she doesn't, and she told me she was told to marry him. Her father wanted her to marry this English guy, and she married him. And she says, William, when I was your age, we didn't ask questions. That's her attitude. And that's what she told me about her upbringing. So I know the names of all her grandparents, and that's about it. and roughly where they were from, but it doesn't go back very far past her because she was raised not to ask, not to pry into family business, not to ask questions, not to pester her parents, and that's how she lived. Some kind of Baptist, New England Baptist discipline that I don't see much sense to.
Well, you shouldn't really have that much trouble tracing back the name Finkelstein.
Right. No, I could actually trace my Fink family back long before I could trace my New England Yankee ancestors. I could trace my German ancestors back 10 generations. I can only trace my mother's back 4 or 5 past her.
I think one of the things we need to get out of our system, so, you know, it's important for the plan and for Yahweh's the purpose in order that Israel would forget who they were. But that time is over, and the time now is that we should again embrace our heritage. And you know what I find with a lot of people is they don't think their children can understand at the age you really ought to be talking about it. They believe that, you know, there'll come a time when we need to. I hear Fulton here talking about his little grandson and telling him things, and they understand a lot more than what we give them credit for. Even little ones, you know, 3, 4, 5 years old, need to be taught about who they are, and that way they will remain, or at least they at least know that they should be pure. They may not remain that way.
Well, my great-grandmother used to boast about having ancestors on a Mayflower. But she never told me how or who or where they were. I mean, you know, I don't know if it was a vain, empty boast or if there was something to it. But I'll probably never know, right? But she was English and Scottish. So who knows? She liked to say that, but she didn't have the records to back it up, right? So.
Y'all ready to start?
And if I knew my ancestors were on a Mayflower, I'd just yell at them for screwing up anyway.
They might yell back at you, too. They might see some things that we need to do differently, for sure.
Well, that's all I had to say about the chronology. So we should bear that in mind or make a note of it or something, that there are only 11 generations recorded from Judah all the way down to David. And that's 900 and something years.
I'm way behind you, people.
Who wants to do the honor? Randy, you want to start it, or...
It doesn't matter to me. Yeah.
We can flip a coin.
I'll give it a try.
Well, you know, I think that it may I make a suggestion?
Sure.
You can shoot me down if you want
I'll
to.
I'll shoot you down either
I
way.
I know you will. With these hard names, just kind of, you know, don't dwell on trying to get every vowel pronounced. Just do the best you can and go on, you know.
We strive for accuracy.
Accuracy. Well, that's
what chapter are we on?
Chapter 3,
okay,
I think.
That's where I'm at. Sure.
See, I knew. I've been keeping up.
I want to say one more thing about the Septuagint. In 1 Chronicles chapter 1, the descendants of Ham aren't mentioned, right? Which is interesting. There's about 10 blank verses between verse 10 and verse 24. It's not really that important, but I thought I'd throw it in there.
Randy, why don't you let me go ahead and jump on chapter 3 since I think you left off.
Yeah, I did too, so you're to turn.
But who's keeping score? Yeah. I didn't know Randy was keeping score. Okay, chapter 3, Gerald, these are the sons of David.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, these were the sons of David which were born unto him in Hebron. Firstborn Amnon, of Ahinoam, the Jezreelitess, the second Daniel, of Abigail, and Carmela's death. The third, Absalom, son of Machai, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah, the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah of Abital. The sixth, Ithram by Eglah, his wife. These six were born to him in Hebron, and there he reigned 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem he reigned 33 years. And these were born unto him in Jerusalem, Shemaiah and Shobab, and Nathan and Solomon, four of Bathsheba, the daughter of Amiel. Ibar also, and Elishama, and Eliphelet, and Noga, and Nepheg, and Japhia. And Elishama, and Elida, and Eliphelet. Nine. These were all the sons of David, beside the sons of the concubines, and Tamar, their sister. And Solomon's son was Rehoboam, and Abiah his son, and Asa his son, Jehoshaphat his son, Joram his son, Ahaziah his son, and Joash his son, Amaziah his son, Azariah his son, Jotham his son, Ahaz his son, Hezekiah his son, Manasseh his son, Amon his son, Josiah his son. And the sons of Josiah were the firstborn Johanan, the second were Jehoiakim, the third Zedekiah, the fourth Shalom. And the sons of Jehoiakim, Jeconiah his son, Zedekiah his son. And the sons of Jeconiah, Asir, Salathiel, his son. Malchiram also, Bediah, his, and Shenazar. Jeremiah, Heshom, Amah, and Nebiah. And the sons of Bediah were Zerubbabel and Shemel, and the sons of Zerubbabel. Have a hard time with that one.
Zerubbabel?
And Hananiah and Shilameth, their sisters. And Hashuba and Ahel and Baruchiah and Hasadiah and Jushabah, dead, five. And the sons of Hananiah, Hiah, and Josiah, the sons of Rephaiah, the sons of Arman, the sons of Obadiah, the sons of Shechaniah. And the sons of Shechaniah, Shemaiah, and the sons of Shemaiah, Hattush, and Egel, and Beriah, and Neariah, and Shaphat, six. And the sons of Neariah, Eloniah, and Hezekiah, and Azrakim, three. And the sons of Eloniah were Hodiah, and Elishib, and Peliah, and Acho, and Johanan, and Deliah, and Anai, seven. How's that, Jerry?
You practice. That's why you wanted to read this chapter. You've been practicing.
I promise you there's no practicing that.
Now, just for there will be a short quiz after this study tonight.
Yeah, you know, if I had the time, it's one thing that might be worthwhile doing someday is to take this chronicle, you know, three chronicles, and compare this to the genealogies of Christ, but also to the books of Ezra and Nehemiah, and looking for these people, because this is taking the genealogy of David all the way into the Second Temple period. And deep into it, because Zerubbabel, mentioned in verse 19, he is the governor of Judea. He's appointed governor of Judea by the Persians, and he was the governor of Judea in the late 6th century, when the Second Temple was built in 520 to 516 B.C. And Nehemiah was the governor of Judea after him. from 502 to 490 BC. So this is, you know, last week I had discussed how Chronicles was a later compilation of the kingdom records by somebody who is often supposed to be Ezra. Well, this is one of the reasons why. Because these chronicles, Ezra was called the scribe, and these chronicles were evidently composed from a larger set of records, which must have been fragmentary, and composed sometime in the period of Ezra and Nehemiah, and we see this genealogy carried down to that time, which proves that position is the correct position.
Makes sense.
So this had to be compiled later. There's no doubt. Now, whoever compiled it took it from records that were a hell of a lot better than anything that we ended up with, right? I mean, we would love to have the records that this compiler used to compile this chronicle. But this is a compilation of a larger set of records. It has to be. And it's carried down here.
You know, I've said it before, no telling how much of these records were actually destroyed in the fire at Alexandria.
Well, yeah, you know, that there's probably something to that, but it's not only Alexandria was kind of late, right? I mean, there were all kinds of records throughout our history that were lost. Yeah, you know, we wouldn't have half the Greek classics we have if it weren't for the Irish monks, because the Vandals and the Goths, they leveled Rome. I mean, they destroyed everything, and the the Germanic wars against the Romans, most of the records that Rome had were lost. Most of the Greek classics that we saved have been saved because of the Greeks and the Irish. So there's no, you know, the Vandals in the 6th, 7th century, they didn't give a damn about Roman books and records. They didn't care about the poetry of Homer and Ovid. Irish monks.
Well, you better get busy because you got a lot of translating to do.
Yeah, you know, I can't really. I would love to have an Old Testament translation, but the thing that doesn't excite me about it is the lack of decent manuscripts. Yeah, you know, I mean, the Septuagint manuscripts, that they're not old enough. The Hebrew manuscripts we have, they're not old enough. They're Jew. They're Kike Jew perversions, the 6th century A.D., the 10th century A.D., they're not. I would get excited if I had something really, like, if I had the manuscripts that Josephus had, I would learn Hebrew, I swear.
It's a good thing that the manuscripts weren't created here in Louisiana. They wouldn't have known them lasted past about 50 years. it would all deteriorate. Now, that might be part of why some of it was in the area it was in for preservation purposes. You can't keep anything here very long.
Yeah, well, that's right. That dry climate is that's why we got the Dead Sea Scrolls that we do, because the climate was very dry. Which is a lot more amenable to the preservation of papyri and of vellum.
They could be copper plates in here. It wouldn't last but a few hundred years.
Right. The humidity kills them. The moisture kills them. And we actually have copper plates. The copper scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls is...
No, he knows what he's doing.
The copper scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls is every bit of 2,000 years old. It's the war scroll. It's actually written on copper. And it's also called the copper scroll.
If you want it, it'll be fine.
My turn?
Yes, sir.
Now, notice how the sons of David are recorded before the sons of Judah, even though David was the son of Judah, and the sons of Judah have already been recorded. This is basically the second time.
That's what I was going to say. We've already been through some of this. All right, I'm going to give you chapter 4, Tribe. The sons of Judah, Phares, Hezron, Carmi, and Hur, and Shobal. Reaiah, the son of Shobal, begat Jahath, and Jahath begat Ahumaiah and Lahad. These are the families of the Zorathites, and these were of the father of Edom, Jezreel, and Ishma, Idbash, and the name of their sister, Hazael-Pharai. Enuel, the father of Gedor, and Ezer, the father of Hushai. These are the sons of Hur, the firstborn of Ephrathai, the father of Bethlehem. Azer, the father of Tekoa, and two wives, Helah and Nara. Nara bare him Ahuzim and Hefer, Nia, and Timina, Ashtai, and these were the sons of Nara. The sons of Helah were Zerith and Jezorah and Ethnan. Boaz beget Enub and Zobibah, families of Ahariah, the son of Haram. And Jabez was more honorable than his brethren, and his mother called his name Jabez, saying, "Because I bear him the sorrow." Jabez called on the God of Israel, saying, "Oh, that thou wouldst bless me indeed, and enlarge my coast, and that thy hand might be with me, and that thou wouldst keep me from evil, that it may not grieve me." And God granted him that which he requested. Kind of interesting that little comment is stuck right in the middle of that.
Well, there's a lot of little stories like that throughout the Chronicles that are really like, side stories. But I think that they show us the attitudes of people at various times, right?
Right.
And I think one of the lessons here is that Jabez was more honorable than his brethren, that most people are just like most people today. They don't give a damn about God or about their obligations to their nation or their people. They only care about showing their bellies and going about their business. So this little aside about Jabez, if he's being distinguished for doing this, that means that most people aren't, right?
Right. That the prayer of most people is for, like you say, their immediate circumstances and belly. Being rich and having plenty. Instead that their prodigy would prosper and all. Right? And Chelub, the brother of Shua, begat Meher, which was the father of Eshton. And Eshton begat Bethrapha, Aziah, Ehemna, the father of Ir-Nahash. These are the men of Rechem. Sons of Kenaz, Othniel, and Sariah, and the sons of Othniel, Hathath, and Eonithiah beget Othra, and Sariah beget Joab, the father of the valley of Cheresim, for they were craftsmen. Sons of Caleb, the son of Japheth, Iru, Elah, Nain, and the sons of Elah, even Kenaz.
Now it seems to me that the word father, this is the second time we've seen it, at least in reference to reference to geography, right? Instead of genealogy, we saw the father of Bethlehem. Now we see the father of the valley of Karashim. And I think that's probably like a patronymic honor that if you move to, like, Walton Mountain with the Waltons, right? Yeah, you know what I mean? That this man moved to this mountain or to this valley or went to this hamlet and founded a town, and he was considered the father of the town, but we could safely assume that most of the people in the place are his descendants, right, or his kin. That's the way I look at that usage.
Does that word have something to do with being craftsmen? Well, it appears like that they, you know, just so they're a craftsman.
Yeah, that word is also has to do with being magicians, right? Magic arts. Keresh. Strong's number 2791. So there's probably something more there than it's not as innocuous as it seems, right? Let me see what the Septuagint says in that The Septuagint says that they were artificers. The Greek word is tektones, and a tekton is a craftsman, right? It's not a magician. But the Hebrew, the Strong's Enhanced Lexicon is trying to say that these people were magicians.
Well, that seems to me like in that society and age that, you know, to be involved in something like what we would consider to be magicians and all would be almost parasitic in nature, and you're not really producing anything. Whereas you wouldn't think there'd be a big demand for it.
Well, right, there shouldn't be, but people get bored at night, right? Let's see, Karash, to scratch. Yeah. You see, this modern Hebrew, I mean, a lot of this is you really have to look at all the words in a group, right? It's keres is a word that has to do with pottery. Karash is a word that has to do with engraving, fabricating things. And that's this enhanced Strong's lexicon isn't fair sometimes. Koresh, it's a craft, and it could have be related to the magic arts, but not necessarily. It could just be any plain craftsman, anybody who fabricates things, and not necessarily in the sense of a wizard or a magician, right, which is sorcery. So I don't think that this lexicon, that this enhanced Strong's lexicon that I have in the software program on my computer, it's not always fair. I've caught it quite often. And this is one of those instances. I'm glad you brought it up.
All right. 16. And the sons of Jehaliel, Ziph and Ziphoth, Tyriah, Azarel. And the sons of Azar were Jeter and Merad and Epher and Jalon, and she bare Miriam and Shammai and Ishbah, the father of Eshtemoa.
Now, Miriam comes from a Hebrew word, and it does come from a Hebrew word that means rebellion. And we see how popular that name is later on at the time of Christ, right?
Right. A lot of people say that it seems that, you know, Mary and Martha kind of represent the two houses. I don't know. What do you think of that?
I think they're probably reading too much into that.
You might say that you're pretty much a...
Right. what we see, what I see in Maria and Miriam and Martha are, as Christ explains, the different roles that we have in life, and some of us have that role where we're to serve others, and that was Martha, right? She was preparing the meals, she was putting the plates out, she was doing the housework, and her sister was sitting on her butt listening to Christ, right? And Martha complained about it, and Christ told her, well, that's her role, and that's your role, and that's the way it is. That's the way life is. We should accept our role in life and not complain or whine about it. Some of us are going to have to work harder than others. Some of us are going to have to get our hands dirty, and some of us are going to look like what we're having an easier life. But, you know, we all have our reward in heaven, and we all have our reasons for doing the things we do here.
All right, yes, it's also interesting to me that the name that would these people would understand exactly what that meant, that rebellious wouldn't be something that you'd necessarily want to saddle your child with right off the bat, you know, even though we know how popular it was.
Right.
All right. And his wife, Jedidiah, bare Jared, the father of Gedor, and Heber, the father of Soko, and Jekathiel, the father of Zoniah, and these are the sons of Bithiah, daughter of Pharaoh, which Merid took, and the sons of his wife, Hodiah, the sister of Naham, and the father of La, Darmite, Eshtimoa, Akathite. And these sons of Shimon were Amnon and Rinnah, Benhanan and Talon. And the sons of Ishai were Zoheth, Ben-Zoheth. Sons of Shelah, the son of Judah, were Er, the father of Lekah, Beata, the father of Marasha, and the families of the house of them that wrought fine linen of the house of Ashbeah. Jochim, and the men of Kolzeba, and Joash, and Zareph, had the dominion in Moab. Joshubai, Lahim, and these were ancient things.
Well, this is written, this is being written 500 years after the time of David, right? And probably 1,300 years after the time of Judah. If this is being compiled in the 5th century B.C., as we've already seen that it has to be because of the way the genealogies are carried down all the way to that time, then whoever the scribe is saying that these are the ancient genealogies, that these are the ancient things that we were told. Now we're told here that two Israelite men have the dominion in Moab.
Mm-hmm.
And we see that the land of Moab, half of it was taken by the children of Israel. And we see that Judah was to have the scepter. So we see that these men must have been judges in Moab at one time. And basically we see the fulfillment of that prophecy, but we also see that there are Israelites with the dominion in Moab, and Naomi wasn't Ruth wasn't a Moabitess.
Yeah, not because of heritage, but because of geography.
Right, and here we see, and it's evident several places here that we see the gray area between geography and genealogy. And that's always been a mistake of our people, but it's only perceived as a mistake after we screw up and let aliens in and start mixing with them. That's when it matters. It don't matter before then. Well, when everybody was white, to be a Yankee or to be a rebel everybody was white. So what the hell? He's from West Virginia and I'm from Massachusetts. Yeah, you know, that's we don't see a problem with that until the aliens get in and we start mixing it up. And then the confusion between geography and genealogy becomes important. Yeah, even in Europe, we had the Norsemen and the men of the Sudetenland and the Westmen and people were identified by geography, and in Europe 2,000 years later, right?
Well,
but they were all German and they were all white.
If you're going to recognize the fact that it was against father's desire, purpose, and plan and will, and for proved to be anything but pure, then you're going to be looking for an example to prove that Father's incapable of completing what he started and what he promised.
Well, absolutely.
And so just the fact that her being where she was at in the genealogy proves her heritage to me.
Well, right, but the race mixers will always look for that excuse, right?
Yeah, and that's very poor to build a doctrine from an example. Especially, I told a fellow that one time before, he brought his three, everybody knows the three examples they always hit you with. And I told him, I said, what about all of the hundreds of examples where it brought about heartache and loss of heritage? Why do you want to go and find three places where you believe that it shows that God don't even care when there's hundreds of places that absolutely show that he does? But it's very important. If you're going to build your doctrine from examples, let's look at the whole picture .
Well, it's right here in this chapter, there's another example, and that's Kenaz is mentioned here in 1 Chronicles 4:13 and 4:15, and he's related to Caleb. And that there are people, even in Christian identity, that'll take you to the Exodus story or to the story in Joshua, wherever it is. I think it's in, it's in Joshua and Judges. That they'll take you to Joshua and Judges where it talks about Caleb and Kenaz, and they'll try to convince us, and I've seen people in Christian identity do this, that Caleb was an Edomite. And it's right here, Kenaz, just because Esau had a son named Kenaz. But here we see Kenaz is a descendant of Judah. Yeah, the name just means hunter. How many people do we have named Hunter in America today? And I'm sure a couple of them are Edomites, and most of them are probably either Israelites or Negroes.
You pick your phone book up and go find you a Joseph and dial it, and you can't tell what you're talking to.
Well, right. Well, we have Kenaz the Hunter. Yeah, that's his name, and he's a man of Judah, and that's who Caleb's related to. He's not related to Kenaz the Edomite, but I've been hit with that question at least four or five times over the last 3 years. Was Caleb an Edomite? Look, he's related to Kenaz. Kenaz is the son of Esau. Well, right, but there's a Kenaz that's the son of Judah.
Have y'all noticed the trend for African heritage people to get away from Israelite names in the past years?
Oh yeah,
when they first 100 years ago, they all wanted to have the
Abraham.
Yeah, they wanted to be Moses and Abraham and
Abraham.
And Joseph and now it's 18 syllables spelled every which way there is.
Feel at verse 21. The sons of Shelah, the son of Judah.
Right, they're always there. They're there throughout the Exodus. They've always been attached to Judah, the Canaanites. There's no doubt.
Hell, in verse 21, the sons of Shelah, the son of Judah, it mentions linen. Rahab.
Well, right. That's what they must have been doing in the land of Canaan, was making linen.
I'm thinking about Rahab, when they were going there. Well, she,
Well, right. Well, Rahab was making linen because of her profession as an innkeeper, right? And she made her own linen from flax. There's innkeepers, I imagine, probably have a lot of spare time on her hands. So that they occupy themselves in making things for their own taverns or their own inns. I don't see Rahab being connected to the Canaanite sons of Judah simply because she had an occupation, which required her to have large amounts of linen, which is what an innkeeper would need.
Well, his two boys were the one that was supposed to marry Tamar, right?
Yeah, it's interesting to me that Sheila named his son Er too, which would have to be after the uncle there that was killed. You see the sons of Sheila, the son of Judah, and
right.
About Er, but that's not Er, Judah's son, because he's dead.
Right.
That's Cheetah's son, but yet he named him after his brother, you know. So,
because Tamar was poster boy.
Yeah.
Aaron and Onan.
Yeah.
Now, in verse 23, it says that the children of and I should have mentioned this earlier, because I always thought this was funny. It says that the descendants of Shelah were also potters, and they lived in plants and hedges. And that's actually the King James translators translated two words that shouldn't have been translated. It should have said that they lived in Netaim and Gadara, and the word Gadara, and there's several places in Palestine named Gadara, and it means a hedge, and the word Netaim means plants, right? But the King James translators translated it, and they're telling us that these people lived in plants and hedges, which is actually pretty funny.
They lived out in the shrubbery, huh?
Well, right. They lived in the bushes. But it should be Netaim and Gadara.
That's pretty interesting, that fine linen you pointed out there, though.
In the Septuagint, it says Etaim and Atayim without the N and Gadara.
All right, verse 24. The sons of Simeon were Nemuel and Jaim and Jerib, Dara, Shaul, Shalem his son, Misham his son, Mishma his son, and the sons of Mishma, Hanuel his son, Zachor his son, Shimei his son. And Shimei had 16 sons and 6 daughters, but his brethren had not many children, neither did all the family multiply like to the children of Judah. And they dwelt at Beersheba and Moladah and Hazar Shael and at Bilhah and at Etham and at Tolan and at Bethuel and at Holmah and at Siglag and at Beth Markaboth and Hazar Susim and at Beth Beriah and at Shariam. And these were the cities under the reign of David. And their villages were Edom and An, Rimmon, Toshin, Ashen, 5 cities, and all their villages were round about the same cities under Baal. And these were their habitations and their genealogy. And Mishabah and Jamlik and Joshan and the sons of Amaziah and Joel and Jehu, the son of Josabiah, and son of Sherebiah, the son of Ashiel, and Elioenaiah, and Jacobah, and Jeshohiah, and Azariah, and Adiel, and Jesimiel, and Benaiah, and Ziza, the son of Shifi, the son of Elon, son of Jediah, the son of Shimri, the son of Shimeiah. These mentioned by their names were princes in their families, and the house of their fathers increased greatly, and they went to the entrance of Gedor, even into the east side of the valley, pasture for their flock. They found fat pasture and good, and the land was wide and quiet and peaceful. For they of Ham had dwelt there of old. And these written by name came in the days of Hezekiah, king of Judah, and smote their tents and the inhabitants that were found there, and destroyed them utterly unto this day, and dwelt in their rooms, because there was pasture for their flocks. And some of them, even the sons of Simeon, 500 men, went to Mount Seir, having for their captains Pelatiah and Neariah and Raphaiah and Uziel, the sons of Ishai. And they smote the rest of the Amalekites that were escaped and dwelt there unto this day.
The guy carved that in rock was busy, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Well, I'll tell you what.
Now, this is basically telling us that some of the Simeonites went down to the land of Esau and at Mount Seir and dwell there. And where it says unto this day, that might be the 5th century B.C.
That would make sense that that's the way it would be written. The Amalekites there, they had destroyed the rest of the Amalekites there.
Well, right, but the Edomites were always there also.
Oh, yeah, well.
And the Edomites are there in historic times. Now, and these things written by name came in the days of Hezekiah, the king of Judah, and smote their tents and the habitations that were found there and destroyed them utterly unto this day and dwelt in their rooms because there was pasture for their flocks. And some of them, sometime later, went to even some of the sons of Simeon. So these men weren't in the deportations of the Israelites, right? And after the days of Hezekiah, who was the last king, he was one of the last kings. Was he the last or was Zedekiah? Zedekiah, I think, was the last, right? I always get him confused, I'm sorry. But sometime in the late kingdom period, that we see that some of these Simeonites had gone to Mount Seir to the old land of Esau, and at that same time, the Edomites were moving up into the land of Israel.
Yeah, as soon as Jerusalem was cleaned out of the nobles, the Edomites moved right in.
Right. Zedekiah was the last king. Hezekiah was 729 to 699 B.C., but he was a king in Judah at the time when the deportations of Israel were beginning, right? That they began around 721.
Hezekiah was king when the Assyrians first encompassed.
Right. Right.
Zedekiah was the one when it fell.
Right. Hezekiah was the king that was that the Assyrian inscriptions say was locked up in Jerusalem like a bird in a cage. I'm going to read that in a couple of weeks for a program. He was, 46 fenced cities of Judah were taken at that time, and Jerusalem did not fall but withstood the siege and lasted until the time of Zedekiah or another 110 years. Well, we see at this time that Simeonites are going down into Mount Seir. That's the land of Esau. And dwelling in the land of Esau. And they may have done that to escape the deportations. We're not exactly told that here. But they may have done that to escape the Assyrians. However, it's at the same time that the Edomites are moving north into the land of Israel. So and that's clear from the book of Ezekiel. So things are getting all mixed up at this time, right?
The rescue of Jerusalem was largely on part of what Hezekiah did too, of his attitude.
Mm-hmm. Right. Now the Amalekites, they are part of the Edomites, right?
Right.
Amalek was one of the sons of Esau. So we're talking about destroying the Edomites out of Seir. Well, Simeon's doing that may have assisted in some of the Edomites moving up into Palestine and into Israel.
Yeah, they didn't never get them all. They wouldn't still be around.
Well, there's a lot more to this history, and the Bible is only giving us a summary, right? But I would bet that the Simeonites had gone down into Seir to get away from the Assyrian conquest of Israel, because it's right in that time frame that it's happening, from the time of Hezekiah. So that's pretty interesting. My interest has peaked now with this. That this passage. I wish we had more complete records.
I wonder how many of the Amalekites, and if Saul had done what was supposed to have done, how much of these problems with the Amalekites would have been.
Well, right. But, Yahweh foresaw it. He said, I'd make war with Amalek from generation to generation.
Yeah.
That the The Edomites were probably spread out a lot further than we realize by this time, too, right? Into Babylon and along the trade routes and into Egypt. And I would bet that they're up in Syria. They're probably all over Mesopotamia. But the Mitanni kingdom of northern Syria is you know, recognized by archaeologists to be Aryan and Hurrian in nature, that it had a dual nature, that the ruling class was Indo-Aryan, they call them. Well, they're the real Shemites, right? And the underclass are labeled as Hurrians by archaeologists. And the Hurrians are the Horites. And the Horites are Canaanites. And Esau went to dwell in Mount Horus, and that was the old name for Mount Seir, what was Mount Horus. So Esau blended in with the Horites, with the Hurrians. And sometimes in Genesis, that word is written Hivite, and it can be demonstrated that just like Aram and Edom are confused, Hivite is a misunderstanding, a scribal misunderstanding of the word that should be Horite or Hurrian to the archaeologists, and the Horites are Canaanites. That I lost track of what I was going to say. Brilliant. The Canaanites, you know, that they can be found in archaeology all the time. Now, Seir was a very defensible place, right? It's called Petra today, and it was actually a very narrow valley of rock, and these people carved ornate facades into the sides of these mountains and lived in the caves carved out from the facade. And in the facades, they look like Greek temples and stuff. They're really really attractive, except that you're living on a building, you know, that's carved into the side of a cave. You're really living in a cave with a fancy entrance, right? And it was very defensible because it was that there's only a narrow passage into it between the mountains, and it's very easy to defend from invasion because of that.
Well, they were more herdsmen than agricultural related.
They were basically caravan robbers and merchants.
Right in the middle of those trails, when they come through that, they all wasn't better. That was the start of the Democrat Party. A lot of brown people live there. Ripped off.
That's what they got in trouble for in Jerusalem, you know. Coming in stealing the heritage.
Chapter 5-0?
Yeah, 10.
Okay. Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but for as much as he defiled his father's dead, his birthright was given unto the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel.
Now he didn't do what Ham did and sleep with his mother, right? He slept with one of the concubines. I don't remember if it was Zilhar or Bilhar, or I don't even know if we really know. But he slept with one of those two handmaidens that were given to Rachel and Leah, and ended up being reckoned amongst Jacob's wives. That the one of the apocryphal books, I don't know if it was Jasher or which one it was, said that it was Dan's mother, which I think was Bilhar. I'm not sure.
And the genealogy is not to be reckoned after the birthright. For Judah prevailed above his brethren, and of him came the chief ruler. But the birthright was Joseph. The sons, I say, of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, were Hanok and Palu, Hezron and Carmi. The sons of Joel, Ahiah his son, Gog his son, Shimei his son, Micah his son, Gaia his son, Baal his son, Zerah his son, who Tilmarsur, king of Assyria, carried away captive. He was prince of the Reubenites. His brethren, by their families, were when the genealogy of their generations was reckoned were the chief, Bel and Zechariah. And Bela, the son of Azaz, the son of Shema, the son of Joel, who dwelt in Aror, even unto Nebo, Baalmeon. And eastward he inhabited unto the entering in of the wilderness from the river Euphrates, because their cattle were multiplied in the land of Gilead. And in the days of Saul, they made war with the Hagarites, who fell by their hand, and they dwelt in their tents throughout all the east land of Gilead.
Now it says, and eastward he dwelt unto the entering. It's quite a trip from the Jordan to the Euphrates, right? I mean, it's I don't know how many hundreds of miles, but it's probably a couple of hundred miles at least from the Jordan to the Euphrates, or across the desert. And I'm sure that this land wasn't so badly. Yeah, you know, it probably was a lot more fertile than it is now. But it's a good 300 or 400 miles from the Jordan and the land of Reuben to the Euphrates. That's no small amount of land. Now,
do they have camels back then?
Oh yeah, definitely. Now part of the promise to Abraham, what was that his descendants would inherit all the land from the river of Egypt to the Euphrates, and that was probably fulfilled in the time of the kingdom years of Israel. But we don't get, you know, the narratives are so centered on what's going on in Israel proper that it never looks towards the extremities and what's happening in these lands that the Israelites are spreading out into. It never does. In the books of Kings and Chronicles, you don't hear too much at all of what's happening beyond Syria and Egypt and the immediate land of the children of Israel, as it was first drawn out in Judges.
Okay, verse 11. The children of Gad dwelt over against them in the land of Bashan unto Selka. Joel the chief, and Shipham the next, and Janai, and Shaphat, and Bashan, and their brethren of the house of their fathers were Michael, and Meshulam, and Sheba, and Jeriah, and Jachon, and Zia, and Heber, seven. These are the children of Abihal, the son of Huri, the son of Jeroah, the son of Gilead, the son of Michael, the son of Jeshishai, the son of Jadu, the son of Buzz.
Now let me say something real quick, and especially to Randy. That word Huri means linen weaver, right?
Okay.
I mean, linen, the making of linen was a really popular trade back then because it was really necessary, right? The making of cloth.
Thank you.
Not only did they use it for their inns and for their clothing, but they used it for their tents and for their pasturage, right? I mean, there's a great demand for cloth making back then. In today's society, we don't even really see the demand for cloth making because it's all made in China, right?
Yeah.
The textile, I'm sure it was big down south in the 40s and 50s, but it's gone now.
But we have no love for our brethren, and we'd rather save a nickel than to see our people work.
Absolutely.
Why do y'all think that it appears like in some instances, that the father's desire for the birthright holder or the blessings way more important than in other cases. That it looks like, you know, as Abraham, he wanted Eleazar, then he wanted Ishmael, and yet with Jacob, he was able to pretty much shift the birthright to grandsons instead of the next in line, even when Reuben did what he did. And it seems like it came at the will of Jacob. Why do you think it was so easy for him to make that change?
Well, because it worked in with the plan of God, that not one tribe alone of the children of Israel would inherit the blessings of the firstborn, that the tribes would be, yeah, you know, their blessings would be spread more evenly. That's the way I look at that. And that's what happened. The priesthood went to Levi, the scepter went to Judah, the double portion went to Joseph, and it was all broken up. And instead of just going to the next heir, right, which would be Simeon, who was passed over,
yeah.
I think was next after Reuben.
You know, basically, when Manasseh and Ephraim were pretty much adopted in, they were put in the first two places. Of the sonship, you know, that's what.
Well, right, but they were the sons of the wife that Joseph that Jacob loved. You know, Joseph was the son of Rachel, the oldest son of Rachel, and that's the one that Jacob really wanted.
That's what I was asking. It seems like that that Jacob's desire for it carried a little weight there, even though I agree with you that it was a sovereignty issue, you know, and it's what he always wanted all along. But Abraham, he tried hard. Father never recognized that, you know. He always told him no. Now, of course, I realized, too, there was promises to Sarah.
Well, I really think that Yahweh, that Abraham is our example, that no matter how bad things get, that the word of God is going to be fulfilled. Abraham's 99 years old. And has a child. And Sarah is 90 years old and has a child with Abraham. That no matter how bleak things look, well, when you're looking at the end of that Melchizedek line and the end of the line of the eldest, and Yahweh transfers these promises all to Abraham, the survival of our race is transferred to the shoulders of this one man, Abraham. Because the rest of the race is destined to be overrun by aliens and mixed in, and that's what happened to them. And Abraham was chosen out of that mess that the ancient Adamic world became. And other white tribes did live into the Christian era, but that they all became secondary to the children of Israel. At the time of Christ, the Scythians, the Romans, and the Parthians had world hegemony over the Adamic world, over all the other nations that were much older, the Assyrians, the Egyptians, the Medes, the Persians, the Ionians, were all much greater nations than the Israelites at one time. And that's the so that we could see the efficacy of the promises of God and how powerful, and Paul explains that in Romans chapter 9 and later on in several of his epistles, that we see how bleak things could look and how Yahweh could take a 90-year-old man and woman and say that, you know, your children are going to inherit the world, and they don't even have children yet. They don't even have children yet. And that, to me, you know, shows that we have the rest of these promises in the Bible, that no matter how bad things get today, we should have confidence and know that the word of God is going to be fulfilled. I don't care how many Jews are in charge. I don't care how many niggers overrun our society. The word of our God is going to be fulfilled, and we are going to prevail.
Okay, let's say that.
Abraham.
So Benjamin was the first, right?
Is our example.
Yeah, Benjamin. That, I mean, of a...
Are we talking about Rachel?
Rachel.
Benjamin was youngest. Joseph was older than Benjamin. Benjamin was a baby.
But through him, the apostle.
Right.
And Manasseh and Ephraim and others were. All the 12, or more than that, but those apostles come through him. It's pretty well through him. A little doubt, but most of them came through Benjamin. We were blessed by that. That's the wife he wanted.
Yeah.
First love, you know.
Okay, verse 15. Ahi, the son of Abdiel, the son of Guni, chief of the house of their fathers. And they dwelt in Gilead, in Bashan, in her towns, and in all the suburbs, Sharon upon their borders. All these were reckoned by genealogies in the days of Jotham, king of Judah, and in the days of Jeroboam, king of Israel. Sons of Reuben and the Gadites and half the tribe of Manasseh, of valiant men, men able to bear buckler and sword, with bow, and skillful in war, were 40,703 and out to the war. They made war with the Hagarites and with Jeter and Nephish and Nodab. They were helped against them, and the Hagarites were delivered into their hand, all that were with them. So they cried to God in the battle. He was entreated of them because they put their trust in him. They took away their cattle, of their camels 50,000, and of sheep 250,000, and of asses 2,000, and of men 100,000.
Now these are descendants of Ishmael, right? Jeter is a son of Israel, right? Ishmael, right?
There's the camels I was asking about, 50,000. For there,
and only 2,000 asses. That don't make any sense.
Well,
you'd think there'd be a lot more donkeys than there would be camels, I would think.
For there fell down many slain, because the war was of God, and they dwelt in their sheds of the captivity. Children of the half-tribe of Manasseh dwelt in the land. They increased from Bashan, Al-Hermon, and Senir, and unto Mount Hermon. These were the heads of the house of their fathers, even Epher, and Ishi, and Eliel, and Azariel, and Jeremiah, Hodviah, Jahiel, mighty men of valor, famous men, and heads of the house of their fathers. And they transgressed against the God of their fathers, and went a-whoring after the gods of the people of the land, whom God destroyed before them. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria, and the spirit of Tilgath-Pilsner, king of Assyria, and he carried them away. Even the Reubenites and the Gadites and half-tribe of Manasseh had brought them into Halah, Habor, and Hara, and to the river Gozan unto this day.
And Ezekiel later writes about those rivers. Now, here again we have another example of the end of Chronicles being at the beginning, right? That this is a late compilation. And if this was done in the time of Ezra, it was done 250 years after this deportation. Because this deportation happened right around 720 B.C. So Ezra is 200 and... Ezra goes to Jerusalem in 457 B.C. That's 260 years later. That this is being recorded. And we see that from chapter 3, that Zerubbabel and a lot of his descendants are mentioned, right? So when you read in the mainstream, and mainstream commentators do state it, that Ezra the Scribe is the one that made Chronicles, we know the Chronicles was at least made a compilation of the history made around the time of Ezra the Scribe. That's fully evident from the book itself. Now, there are some Jews that would say that the and they get away with this in academia, and it's just crazy that they get away with this. There's a school of academics. I don't even know how they're called, scholars. They're clowns. And these are all archaeologists and college professors. And it's called the School of Biblical Minimalism. And these people claim that the Kingdom of Israel was invented by Ezra and Nehemiah, who wrote all these books out of thin air in the 5th century B.C. to give these nomadic tribes of Jews, as if there could be such a thing, an identity. And that's all a lie, because these books are writing about these deportations of Israelites, and we've dug these inscriptions out of the ground in Assyria that match exactly what these books say in many instances. The Assyrian records we've dug out of the ground say the same things about these invasions by the Assyrians and these taking off of all these people, that they say the same thing. And therefore they prove that the books of Chronicles and Kings are basically true chronicles.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long ways to have a lie, you know, and bury stuff in the ground that's already older than the lie is.
Well, right, exactly. And yeah, you know, how the hell did somebody right in this 500 B.C. know that we were going to make these discoveries 25, 27, 2700 years later? But we have. And that's, you know, I don't know where they're coming from. They should be discredited and thrown the fuck out, but their articles still get printed in scholarly journals. Their articles still get, you know, credence in archaeology magazines and in scholarly circles. It shows you that scholarship under the Jews is a joke. It's a plain joke. They don't care about the truth. They all care about their own little agendas. That they should be, anybody that says that Ezra sat down in the 5th century and made this stuff up should just be tossed out of any university in the world. But they get away with it, and they collect a lot of money doing it. And one of the biggest ones is a Jew bastard named Israel Finkelstein. I hate the SOB.
They're doing what they're supposed to do.
Yeah, they are doing their part.
Well, right, and stupid Christians fall for it all the time because they don't read books.
Well, it's tremendously important that propaganda still goes on, because when it stops and your people actually know who they are, then much of the Federal Reserve System and the usury systems and things that bow down to worship them through those areas goes away. You know, this country's been basically worshiping the Antichrist for almost 100 years next year when they sold the Federal Reserve. You know,
1913.
Yeah. So, you know, we're looking at the anniversary of that, a centennial anniversary of the complete selling out of this government system that we have in this country to the Antichrist. You know,
And it won't be 10 people believe in what you said. Because they said, look how we're doing like that. I wouldn't have these 15 cars, 4,000, blah, 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 blah. I wouldn't have all this stuff.
Yeah, you would have all that stuff because
you wouldn't be,
it would be inherited from your parents. You would be inherited property and real goods. You know?
And that jackass would be out there digging cracking rock. We said us cracking rock for him.
Yeah, you wouldn't be having to borrow money to build your house because your family would be putting that together for you.
Right. It wouldn't be any use for it.
Well, we wouldn't have paid trillions of dollars in war machines.
It generates profits for them because they own it.
Have you noticed with war, too, we don't go out, you know, we just talked about these these guys right here, the sons of Reuben, the Gadites, and Manasseh, they decided to go out and steal all the camels and asses and horses and to kill everybody. They don't say that they come in and did anything. I mean, they just went out and conquered. Now, right or wrong, we don't do that anymore. We don't go out and conquer a nation and take their land and come in and set our, you know, make it part of the country or anything. We
conquer a nation, and then the Jews set up a central bank and tax them to death for the rest of their history.
That's why we went there.
And the Jew gets all the booty, and we don't get nothing.
We don't. We've lost our way.
It's interesting, though, that we will fight for, you know, all you got to do is fly a flag over it and sing a song over it, and it's our people in their idea of patriotism and the idea of not wanting to abandon their sons or sucked into this to do these deeds, you know, we all call it, man, you just go up there to Branson, and the way you get your people on your feet at the end of the thing, man, you put a flag up and sing a patriotic song, you know, no matter what evil we're involved in, if you can rename it as patriotic, then we're hook, line, and sinker, you know, that's how they get us to do these things.
When they talk about that. Half-tribe of Manasseh, and all these boys went to war, what portion of those guys fighting were Israelites? And turn that around today, and look at the last day where you're soldiers. Would you like to have him behind you? First thing you need to do is shoot him when you go in there, because he ain't going to be on your side. Remember what Tonto told the Lone Ranger? What you mean we, white man? That's what they're going to do. They're going to chain horses right in the middle of this
field. Well, in the ancient world, soldiers fought for one thing, booty. But at the end of a good career, or at the end of a long war, Roman soldiers were rewarded with booty. They got land. They were given estates. They made out pretty good. And today, fighting for the beast, American soldiers get nothing. It's incredible. And the Jew gets all the booty. The bankers get all the booty.
They fixed to crucify some Marines for urinating on some.
Yeah, yes, they are. They're fixing to crucify some Marines that
you go over and shoot them,
urinated on some dead Afghanis. I don't want to call them soldiers. I don't know what they are, but that these Marines defiled the bodies and urinated on some dead Afghanis. And what they don't understand, the people that sit in these offices and pontificate, Hillary Clinton, I just wanted to smack her when I saw her face on television tonight talking about how appalled she was at these soldiers. You know, they're not out there in the jungles. They're not fighting a war. They have no idea of the pressure that these soldiers are under. They're not in the streets rolling around on the ground with these dirtbags. That they're not having to deal with the day-to-day pressures of being in combat. Who the hell are they to judge these soldiers? Yeah, you know, I mean, boys will be boys. That's the way it is. That's the price of having soldiers. Soldiers have always done dumb things like that. Is it sensible in a civilized world? No. Is war civilized? No. And it's not supposed to be. And soldiers have to be allowed to be soldiers. That's the way it is. And they don't understand.
Where is Jane Fonda?
Don't understand the pressures and the things that come with being in the pits every day. They just don't. And that they're setting themselves as judges over these men, and they're going to crucify them.
Is it possible that whole thing was somewhat of a stain?
And it's a damn pity.
Just to amplify the hatred between the Arabs and us to help the Jews. I mean, the whole thing just seems like it's done in Hollywood to me at times.
We're fighting their fight.
And I'm not saying the war was righteous in the first place. Of course, we know
they posed while they were being filmed.
I mean, I don't doubt it happened.
But we have our boys there, and soldiers have to be allowed to act like soldiers. And sometimes soldiers do stupid things, but yet, you know, if you're living in the dirt for 6 months and getting shot at and having to deal with all that bullshit, well, you got some stupid you got some stupid things coming, right?
Yeah, but I agree with Mark that
that's the way I look at that.
That the on every news channel and all that. There's no accident, you know that. I don't doubt it first showed up on the internet. Now, who filmed it?
How did it get on the internet?
Yeah, there you go.
Is some Zionist behind it? I would bet that there it was.
And why, you know, why did it receive the attention it received? You know, I mean, there's things on the internet every day that in this country that people disrespecting each other more than that. You know,
they're just trying to ratchet us up against Ahmadinejad, as you see, day by day. It's just, you know,
that's what they did with the
Iranians and the Arabs. I mean, it's building. It's going to happen.
That's what they did with Hitler. It was just a production. It was a little more every day and trying to get more and more people to hate Hitler so that we would be willing to go to war. And they finally succeeded.
Bill, speaking of Hillary, you saw where Hillary got up there and denied that America had anything to do with the bombing of that Iranian scientist.
Yeah, right.
We know damn well America and their cohort Israel, you know, were behind the whole stupid thing.
We admitted it. We admitted that we were over there killing the scientists. But it was an American CIA.
Hillary said we had nothing to do with it.
She's a liar.
I get sick to my stomach when I look at her. I just want to puke when I have to look at her. I saw her on television tonight. I just wanted to smack her, I swear.
I'd rather have Obama as president over her any day.
She had her hair all done up like a man, too.
Well, like daughter, like mother. I want to see the last 100 years celebrated with all of the lampposts in this country full. That's what I want to see. They talk about the lynching in the South. That'll be a Sunday school picnic compared to what I want to see.
Well, the power that they exhibit over the people of this country, though, is, you know, that the real problem is us. That just like Wolf and me, you know, the real problem is us. They're not the trouble. They're not the problem.
Don't you hope you're still around driving a Caterpillar when Ezekiel kicks in while you're out there 6 months burying them both? I'm going to get me 2 cases of beer and whiz on and see who takes on your side next. You got it coming.
Bill's recording you, you know.
Well, domestic terrorist.
3 cases of Budweiser. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen.
Yeah,
you're going to have your own end,
but God-forsaken internet. Brown can't stay off. Well, what do you
know? You're not.
You ain't said 2 words earlier.
He's full. Well, it was... He's full, all right. We had a good study tonight, I think. We're almost through the hard part.
Well, there's a lot of good stuff in these genealogies, but I'll bet you're glad you did them now. 2 weeks ago, you wanted to skip them. it's important to see the perspective once you realize that this is from the 5th century looking back, right? And it's important to see that. We wouldn't have seen that if we didn't cover this ground.
Right. Well, I think the boys did real well pronouncing all these hard names.
Randy did
this
week and last week.
Well, Don says he's going to start off with the next chapter next week.
I want to see, you know, when I get down to Louisiana, Don's going to run a chapter. He's going to read a chapter. I'm going to twist his arm.
He'll read the whole book of Obadiah.
All right. I won't pick on Don too much.
I love Obadiah.
Well, Bill, we thank you, and we thank all the people on TeamSpeak listening, and we'll see you, Lord willing, next week.
Tomorrow night.
Okay, I'll see you then, shall we? And tomorrow night it's James chapter 2. Okay, great. Yeah. Good night.
Good night. Bye, Bill.
See you all next week.